L-E-T-E-N-P-C.
Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Nope. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tire. E-Range EV tires are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tire with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetires.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E-Tires.com to find your EV's next set of tires.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Inside EVs podcast. For those of you who don't know me, and that's probably a lot of you if you're regular viewers of the show or listeners to the show, my name is Seth Miersma. I'm the editor-in-chief of the USA Automotive Group at Motorsport Media. That includes Inside EVs, Motor1.com, and Ride Apart. And like I said to most of you guys, I'm a complete stranger. So let's talk about why you're seeing different faces today than you've seen in the past. A lot of you may have already heard, we've seen a few comments about it already, that our original hosts of the Inside EVs podcast have recently left the show and the Inside EVs brand and family. And of course, we love all these guys. We love Dom, Tom, and Kyle, and Martin, and we wish them nothing but the best. But in the meantime, it's been my job to make sure that we're still able to bring you a podcast and to try and ensure that it's the best electric vehicle podcast in the whole world, right? So that's challenging. And so I had to go out and get a lot of help, right? So today I'm happy to say that I'm going to be able to introduce you to some of the regular hosts that will be on the show going forward. And then you'll have a few folks, as myself. We've got senior editor Brett Evans from Motor1.com to sort of fill in a little bit as we ramp up, and hopefully bring you a really fantastic podcast. So, let me start with a really familiar face again, to those of you who have watched the podcast in the past. We've got Miss Go Electric herself, Lacey. Hello. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, really, really awesome to kick this off with you. I think it's going to be super fun. So if you guys don't know, you should check it out. Miss Go Electric has got some amazing content on her own sort of media empire. We were just chatting about how I need to pick her brain on e-mobility, e-bikes and scooters and stuff. So more of that to come, certainly in the future. And then we've also got Hazel Southwell, a journalist who pretty brilliantly writes about everything from motorsport to emerging technologies in transportation and of course, electric vehicles, too. So, Hazel, great to have you.
I'm super excited to be here. Thank you. Well, I'm this week's token British person, so look forward to me like rapidly converting from Celsius to Fahrenheit in my head and probably getting it wrong and stuff. But yeah, it's really cool to be part of this.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I said, I think it's going to be an amazing group. We've got some new folks coming in and people who I think care very deeply about electric vehicles who can contribute meaningfully to what we're doing on this podcast. So it's going to be great. And of course, we're happy to have the transatlantic connection back in place, even though that we have different faces, too. So some of our favorite Brits, some of our favorite Americans, and I think we should be good. I just want to apologize to Tim right off the bat for moving my hands around too much. This is yes, I know. I will attempt to keep my gorilla hands in one place and not tap and make annoying noises in the microphone. But right on. So yeah, now that we've made some introductions, why don't we jump into it, you guys? This has been a huge week for news. So let's talk some EV news, right? Oh man, and there it is, the EV News graphic as promised.
Lovely. So anybody who's been on the site or reading anything about, honestly, it wouldn't even have to be EV specific, the biggest story in all of automotive, I would say over the last couple of days, has been the launch of Cadillac's Escalade IQ. That's the electrified version of Cadillac's Escalade. We are going to see this in person next weekend. I think it's going to be at in Monterey for the Pebble Beach and the Quail and all the festivities out there too. So we're excited to see that. This thing is a monster, you guys. Let's just start that right there. The reaction to this, at least in my social feeds and reading the comments on Inside EVs, have been somewhat polarized, I would say. I think that people who are a little bit more on the drive normal vehicles end of the spectrum right now are responding a lot to this design. And I do think that Cadillac has done a pretty good job of making this look very much like an Escalade, quote unquote, even though they're transitioning that brand into something very different here. On the other hand, I think a lot of us who have driven EVs and kind of care about that technology are looking at this and seeing it as a, 8,000 at least pound, reasonably inefficient, power per weight sort of vehicle, and are questioning why we're doing this kind of thing at all right now, right? So I guess we can start there and go around the room. Like, initial reactions to Cadillac's version of the platform and their first Ultium vehicle. Well, sorry, not first, their most recent Ultium vehicle.
I'll say it probably makes Hazel cringe a little. In the European market, everyone doesn't really appreciate the big vehicles like the Americans do. But I think it looks really good. I'm excited for it because, let's be honest, we need more vehicles that are going to be electric that can fulfill the needs of people that have families. So an up to 7-seater is really important in this marketplace. And I think the specs look pretty good. And yeah, we can talk about inefficiency all day because it's probably going to be just like how the Hummer is, where it's a hog. It stays true to its name. But ultimately, 450 miles of range, there are some improvements that we're seeing kind of from the upgrade from the Hummer already. And the main problem is GM's going to need to get the production ramped up. And I know they're having supply constraints with the battery supply, and lower volume vehicles are good for that. But now, like, how many vehicles now are in the GM portfolio that are said to be electric and they don't have the numbers to kind of, give us what we want, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, putting products in people's hands is really important for sort of acceptance of what you're doing as, across the portfolio of GM brands. And if you're kind of a brand loyalist or somebody who's really interested in one of their new EVs, for sure. And, we actually do. We have a lot of news about GM production stuff, too, that we're going to get to as well. So I totally agree, Lacey. I think this is like the primary hurdle here is, who is going to be able to own one of these and when, right? Like that's always something that we're asking when we're getting into a new vehicle launch. Just so we're all oriented around this too, I think we've already said this is built on the same kind of architecture that we've seen already with Hummer EV truck and SUV. It's right now, Cadillac is only saying a 200 kilowatt hour plus battery pack, but we assume it's the same one, or roughly almost exactly the same that's in Hummer, which is 212, if I'm not mistaken. They're saying 450 miles of range, 350 horsepower, 0-60 in under 5 seconds, tows 8,000 pounds, and starts at $130,000, right? So this is not a vehicle that is for everybody, but Hazel, ask you this, I suppose. In my mind, there's always a balance, right? Like, right, we're still in a place where a brand like Cadillac can launch a vehicle that they could consider to be a sort of halo, bring new people, as Lacey was saying, people with families or people who might have been interested in an ICE Escalade into the brand by way of something like this that's very posh and theoretically pretty cool looking. Does it hurt or help more at this stage to do a massive electrified Escalade?
The aesthetics of the vehicle, I have no comment on pretty much because I don't know if I've ever seen a Cadillac in real life, like this year. I probably have at some point in my life, but like for sure, it's not like a brand where I'm like, wow, it's the Cadillac shape. In terms of what the car is, like, we can talk about old people need cars for their families, yet people don't need a $130,000 luxury vehicle for their families. This is not a need vehicle. This is a luxury vehicle. And like, I would say everything about it is, I was saying to Seth before we went live, like, I think I'm going to like just straight up cast myself as the villain of this podcast. So like, here comes a bit.
Yeah.
There's a lot of factors about this car and about the way that a lot of vehicles, not just by American OEMs, but by OEMs in general, are being made at the moment, which is that nothing on earth, or no vehicle that is like short of like actually a heavy haulage truck, needs a 212 kilowatt hour battery. If you are using a 212 kilowatt hour battery, your car is inefficient. Like, something's gone wrong. You haven't got the regeneration from the braking working properly. The overall vehicle weight is much too heavy. That packaging, that should not be a thing that is happening. That is like inconceivable levels of waste, especially given that the majority of that battery capacity is not going to be being used most of the time. That is going to be a battery that is knackered super fast, because it's not charging to discharge or charging to full and discharging to low. It's going to be constantly being topped up. And like, anyone who's ever had a phone that you plug in regularly will know, like, it kills the battery. Like, these are wasteful uses of the quite difficult to get at the moment Ultium systems.
Right.
There's also, I mean, the whole vehicle is full of things like that. Like, the wheel size is like crazily huge. It doesn't need to be that tall.
24 inch wheels, we're told on this this first version.
Yeah. And you know, that is an aerodynamic inefficiency, it's a road inefficiency, that is all taking stuff out of the range. And then you've got things like that touch screen across the whole front. Mm-hmm. And I think this interests me, because I will be interested to see what the NHTSA says about that touch screen or that infotainment screen, because Mercedes in the EU got in trouble for theirs in the EQS, because they had a whole dashboard touchscreen, or not touchscreen, infotainment screen. And that meant that the driver was using the same screen to put inputs that the passenger could be watching entertainment on. Mm-hmm. And like, that is a big no, because that means technically the driver is interacting with the onboard entertainment, which for obvious reasons, like distracted driving and whatever, isn't allowed. So like, yeah, to me, I'm just kind of like, had to like, just go back and do this better. Like, put 2 months extra into designing this car and make a considerably better car that makes better use of the resources that we actually have. Because things like, I mean, even if you talk about the chips crisis, like, this thing is stuffed full of them.
Absolutely. Like,
this is a nightmare for supply chain. And I don't see how it's going to work.
We have a problem here in America, too, because we have this federal bill that actually encourages them to get paid per kilowatt hour of the batteries that they produce. So you would think that they would want to maximize volume. But, you know, being a company like GM and a legacy automaker, they just rely on their suppliers to get this stuff. So like Hazel was saying, is like, they need to focus on really nailing down, getting things more efficient, because you can make higher volume. And obviously Tesla has figured that out. But all the rest of the legacy automakers, they rely so much on these third-party suppliers. And then on top of that, you have the federal incentive that pays out these companies who are building batteries here in North America to per kilowatt hour, like a good chunk of change, like that they're incentivized.
Yeah, it's the reason, or the way that we got here, right, is complicated. I think that on the from the surface, maybe from the consumer level, there's an idea that, well, Escalades sell very well. We're going to have to make a electric version of an Escalade.
And by the way, I don't know if we're calling this escalatic yet or not, but that's probably in the cards because of the lyric and the IQ sort of conundrum that Cadillac is visiting on us. But yeah, I mean, there are lots of reasons. So going back to the battery capacity, like the unused capacity, I think that's really fascinating, an incredible argument. There's an easily credible argument to be made against that. I think GM might say, or Cadillac might say, it's in the needed sort of skill set of this vehicle to be able to tow. We said 8,000 pounds, or that's the guess right now, but you need to be able to tow something significant. That's something that Cadillac Escalade owners expect to have. And if they're trying to replace, you know, sort of a traditional, an ICE-powered Escalade owner with an EV Escalade owner, it needs to do certain things that maybe lead to these inherent inefficiencies. And I guess the question, Brett, we were talking about this the other day, yeah, when the story first went live. There is the benefit of potentially transitioning somebody into an electric vehicle that might not otherwise be interested, despite the sort of fundamental inefficiencies of a vehicle this size. Yeah,
that's my thought, especially regarding the Hummer EV, because the last time I talked to someone with a Hummer EV, his previous car was a, you know, he said it was like an emissions deleted Ram 3500 diesel. So that was a great substitution process. And I would love to say that, like, I'd love to live in a world where people only buy the car that they need, because that would mean everyone would be driving around in compact hatchbacks and minivans and station wagons, and that's it. But the reality is, Americans buy things that are cool, and this is a great example of something that's just kind of stupid, kind of inefficient, but cool, and it's getting people out of big, much less efficient vehicles, even less efficient vehicles, and into something like that. And I think that the Escaladic is going to do something similar. It's going to get people from.
Kyle, clip that, please. We're going to need that for we're going to need that for Instagram and for TikTok. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think it's going to do something similar. You know, I live in Calabasas, and this is going to sound like a stupid flex, but I live near Calabasas, and I see Kim Kardashian's Escalade all the time, like two or three times a month probably. And I would love to see her in something like this. And with those big 24-inch wheels and that ridiculous G-Wiz screen, it might happen. And I agree wholeheartedly with Hazel's evaluation that it's so inefficient and so unnecessary in so many ways. And that's, you know, but from like a American car market perspective, I think it's the right choice.
And I like to see that there are a couple things on the, like, heat pump. Yes, good. Everyone needs to start incorporating a heat pump to be a little bit more efficient. I know this isn't efficient, but still, like, that kind of technology needs to become the norm. And also the V2H. And GM just announced this past week that, you know, they're starting to expand the lineup of V2H capability. And I love that bidirectional capability with 19.2 kilowatts of AC home charging and sending that energy back to the home. So if you are going to spend $130 at a starting price point, then let me have it be as usable as possible and take that energy out and utilize it for other things, whether it's vehicle to load or vehicle to home. So I can, you know, for me, I'm selfish. I like to charge my e-bikes when I'm out and about, but and take them with me on a rack on the back of the car. But that kind of stuff, I think, is what makes it worth it, that like $130 price point. And of course, yes, it is a luxury vehicle, like Hazel said. So it's not for everyone, but I love the usability factor of it.
Yeah. And listen, we know ultimately that there is going to be a Chevy version of this, right? Like it would be breaking with 100-year-old tradition, essentially, or 70-year-old tradition, to not have a version of the full-size SUV across General Motors brand. So there are a lot of people I'm seeing in the comments. And again, I saw in the comments on this initial story talking about price point, right? Tim, thank you, Tim, by the way, stirring some great conversation in the chat, says, I saw a video of Misko Electric with the GM V2H system last August. They got to get that thing rolling. So your followers are coming with you, Lacey. That's awesome. But my point is that I know that GM has got some amazing, is doing some amazing engineering as ever, right? The company, they have the capacity to engineer things at a world-class standard. The question is always about who they're, and especially today, like how we're allocating these limited resources across their vehicle portfolio. And kind of going back to my other earlier point, right? Is it more important now to make a halo vehicle that's going to get the Kim Kardashians of the world driving it and bring more attention to the fact that General Motors electric vehicles in general? Or is it would it be a smarter play to deploy those same resources across, you know, at a lower price point, much higher volume vehicle that more people can actually access, use, and build loyalty that way? I don't know the answer to that question, but I do think it's a valid question. Oh, well, somebody
here.
Knows.
Cat.
Sorry, it's my
that's
cat.
What they. That's what. That's what she thinks about it.
Yeah, she's a very big cat, so you would think she'd be on board with, like,
Escalade Kitty.
Yeah. She's reasonable, though. She knows what she needs, and she knows she doesn't need $150,000 worth of electric SUV.
Right.
I mean, she's not getting that, so...
Well, listen, so we've already sort of teed up. We've talked a lot about Escalade, and we're very interested to see when it actually gets into public hands. One of the issues that's going to continue to be a problem there is that GM is just having a really hard time building any EVs right now, right? So, you know, we had this story up last week about, and listen, this is just the latest in a chain of stories about GM's production difficulties surrounding Ultium battery vehicles. They had to idle a plant mid-July, I think for 2 weeks, maybe a little more than 2 weeks, because they ran out of batteries, essentially. The Canadian Chemi assembly in Canada was shut down. And more importantly, like talking about some of the smaller, slightly more accessible ones still from Cadillac, this meant that Lyriq builds anyways, are way under where they expected to be, right? So Cadillac was talking about 25,000 of these last year, and they produced 8,200 instead, and those numbers are actually down this year. So, man, talk about supply chain issues. Does anybody have any line of sight to this clearing up soon? Like, is there a blocker that we think is going to be out of the way in the reasonably near future, or is this more of a structural problem right now for GM?
I mean, yes, I do think it is going to change, and it will change fairly quickly because they're throwing billions into Ultium factories. Like, you know, the Ultium or the doors to the first Ultium factory opened like relatively recently, and there's two more big ones coming online in the next couple of years. This is not a forever problem. It's also true that GM is investing in all kinds of supply chain stuff. Like looking at manganese sulfate, for instance, even as a supply thing within the US so that it has like localized supply for the cathodes. And there's going to be a lot of problems that are solved in terms of this. What the problem actually seems to be, and I tried to get hold of GM this morning, but obviously like it's early in the US, because I kind of wanted to check up on this, but it does seem to be that it's the final assembly that is actually the issue. It's not particularly a supply chain issue, or at least it's at the top end of the supply chain. And yeah, things like being able to put the battery together is going to get easier. There will be better supply, there will be better systems, things like production lines are going to get more efficient. It would definitely help if the batteries got smaller. And sure. I realized that this is going to be an annoying thing I say a lot, but the sheer weight and voltage of an over 200 kilowatt hour or sheer weight and capacity, not voltage. And if the comments call me out, that's right. Like of a 212 kilowatt hour battery, that's difficult to move around a production line. It's really hard. It's then difficult to transport. It's difficult to get places. And, you know, there's things that affect getting the battery from the Ultium factory to the car assembly plant that go way beyond just, or like they are supply chain in that they're logistics. But stuff like the fact that moving stuff around on rail is still difficult, and it's going to be difficult for quite a long time. And, you know, these are all factors that GM doesn't have worked out yet, because it has, if you think about the scale of operations of GM and how many production lines it's now trying to feed with Ultium powertrains or Ultium systems, then it's, you know, working out a puzzle that it kind of committed to before it had all of the pieces, pretty much. Does that mean that it will never work it out? No, but just that this is what, you know, we keep talking about this. It's a huge transition phase, the biggest transition phase that the automotive world has ever seen, because the last time there was a transition phase like this from original electric vehicles to internal combustion, the automotive industry was in a you know, fetal state compared to how it is now. And there will be moments like this where car companies that have forever looked like they're completely on top of it just don't anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that anybody believes that GM isn't going to figure out how to build electric vehicles long term, and certainly they're invested in it, right? The question becomes, and in my mind, it's always like ramped up by, you know, even what we write about every day. We see people who are passionately looking for more information about when these vehicles are going to be available, and they want to know, they want updates every day if they can get them, right? Which adds a little bit of intensity to the thought that you might have to wait a couple of years to actually be in or purchase a vehicle that you heard about, you know, yesterday.
Well, and also, do you think there's probably a little sting left from the Bolt recall? Like, they sure don't want to mess up that assembly again, because those tears in the anodes that totally caused a huge problem for them with the whole Bolt situation, they're probably moving forward cautiously. Like, we don't want to have that happen again. That was very costly for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and at the heart too, you know, like GM, I worked at an agency on behalf of a GM brand for a number of years doing some media work. And I can say without a lot of fear of being contradicted that General Motors is an extremely conservative company, right? Like they're absolutely trying to build products that don't break, even though they do break, right? They're trying to build products at a scale that's pretty much unrivaled by all but a few automakers. And I don't think that they're like I said, I don't think that there's any intention or any idea that they won't be able to do this, but there is a lot of frustration around the fact that they're not hitting targets that they're supposed to be hitting already. I mean, going back to an announcement from, I think last year, I can't remember if this was in a GM company press release or if it came from Mary Barra, but they were talking about 100 million unit production capacity for Ultium system vehicles by the end of 2025. Does that feel remotely realistic right now? Because we're well under 10% of the targets that they were setting for things like Lyriq.
I think these factories got to get on board. Like, it just seems to me, and especially if you're putting these 200 plus kilowatt hour packs in there, like, it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on the other hand, moving forward a little bit, we've been bagging on GM a little bit today, so we can have some slightly better news in that Upstart, is it still fair to call Rivian an upstart? I feel like they've been around forever now, but I guess in the landscape of Fords and General Motors of the world, they are. They're losing less money on their vehicles, and they're making a lot more of them than they expected. And not for nothing, the Rivian trucks are pretty awesome to drive. I think that I've had a couple drives in them, and I've really, really enjoyed them. I've heard and read a lot about people actually enjoying owning these products. So what does Rivian know that GM doesn't, I guess, about actually being able to build vehicles and put them on the road?
I mean, I shed a tear every time I talk about Rivian because I have an order in on one, and I have for a really long time. But my order is in on a max pack, and they haven't started producing those yet. And supposedly, I mean, I've had delay after delay after delay, and supposedly they're going to start making it relatively soon this fall. So I'm super excited. I've driven them before. I fit the brand. I love everything that they stand for. I'm a big outdoors person, so it just really suits my lifestyle. But, you know, they had it hard coming out of the gate, because initially you had to have three lines that build up a supply chain, and you had to have suppliers take a chance on you to be able to get the stuff that you need to build on. But I think Rivian also figured, you know, we need to start building stuff in-house more because they had so many off-the-parts shelves that really hindered them, especially when we started having shortages and everything like that. And don't get me wrong, like, they have tried to shake me off of this reservation really hard. They're like, look at all this inventory that we have. Here you go. Take this, you know. No, I want to wait for that. You know, I have 2 300-mile EVs already. I'm good with another 300-mile. I want the max pack with 400 miles because I go out remote and I take really long road trips across the country. So I need it. But now that they're starting to do enduro motors and prioritize making these parts on their own so they can kind of control it more like how Tesla does stuff, I think we're going to see better progression for them as far as profit margins and as far as production goes. So it seems like they're starting to streamline and it's just getting better and better. So I'm super excited about this. And I do think that they're one of the few, like, you know, stock-oriented EV automakers that have come out as a startup that will end up surviving.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, Lacey, about the stock too. I was checking that this morning and ahead of this segment, and you know, it's at a quarter. It was $100 or something like that, kind of out of the gate, and dropped to a low of maybe 12, and it's doubled since then. Since these Q2 numbers have come out again, there's a lot of weirdness that happens in the stock market, especially around electric vehicle company stocks and things like that. So I don't want to read too much into that. But the fact that they've got really positive production numbers, they're still apparently losing money on vehicles, but they're losing a lot less than they were losing before. You do have a lot of technology and a lot of overhead that you need to amortize, like as you start to build these vehicles up to scale. So that's not unheard of, although the numbers can be sort of shocking when you see that. I feel a lot more bullish about Rivian too, particularly because they got a really early start and had some strategic partnerships that I think kicked them off. And now they're in a really good place.
And again,
just to underline, the technology is fantastic. What they're coming out with is impressive. But as a vehicle that you can get in and drive today, it's almost, I don't want to say flawless. There are plenty of things that we can pick apart, but they're really good. So
yeah, they got deep pockets too. They're backed by the Saudis.
Yeah.
Tim has a great point in the comments on YouTube where he says that GM can't decommission or undermine their dozens of factories and contracts with labor and suppliers. That's a great point as to why Rivian is able to succeed where, you know, this big juggernaut is maybe faltering a little bit. They have come in and they've established exactly what they want from day one, which is a great, you know, like one of the great advantages to being like an EV native car company. We saw it with Tesla. We see it a little bit with Lucid. And with Rivian as well, they can come in and build exactly what they want from the ground up, which is it gives them a huge leg up on some of these big, massive establishment companies.
Absolutely.
Although, like, just to make this point, GM has made more EVs than Rivian has. It's just that right now they're having a problem with Ultium.
Sure.
Like, you know, if we're going to compare the two, then even looking at like coming out the box as a big legacy automaker, I don't really love that phrase, but like GM has made and delivered more EVs than Rivian, and there are still big delays on Rivians. Like, I think Rivian turning it round from what was a pretty disastrous last year, like, mm-hmm. they did not look good at the end of last year in terms of deliveries and what they were actually doing and how they were running and finances. Like, the fact that they're now in much better shape, that's how quickly sorting out your issues with deliveries and getting stuff out the door can turn around.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fair to say, too, you're absolutely right. And Tim brings up, too, like, yeah, GM started a long time before. Obviously, we've had Bolt EV and then EUV for quite a long time. Loads of them, those have been produced. The Rivian case is a little bit different. The Cadillac case, the new Ultium vehicles are a little bit different, right? Where now we really are getting into the deep sort of full brand level investment that will shape the future of what these companies are building. And getting to that scale, I think, is where we've seen a lot of the hiccups and some of the dissonance, as we were talking about, between the expectation and the reality on the ground of what's being delivered and stuff. I just want to take a second to you guys, because there have been, again, tons of comment activity, and I really appreciate it. Some of you guys didn't log on to see the start of the show, which is cool. So I'm just going to recap quickly, too. Yeah, so this is part of the new group of long-term regular hosts that we're going to have. Right now, you've got myself and Brett Evans from the Motor One and Inside EVs team standing in a little bit. Hazel and Lacey, you're going to see a lot of going forward. The Tom, Kyle, Dom, and Martin we're all still, you know, friends. You're still going to see Tom Malagni on the website quite a lot, for instance. But they went off to do their own thing too. Nobody was fired. This was totally of their own volition, and we wish them well. So we're stoked that they're able to branch out and do that thing too. We just still want to be able to have a killer podcast for Inside EVs too, for all of our readers and our fans. So if you missed that part, that's the explanation. We have some of that on the site too, so you know. But right on. Okay, so that was a lot of news. We left one bit on the table, but we're going to come back to it because I still want to hear the BMW protection factory visit story at some point from Hazel. But in interest of time, Brett was recently, a couple of weeks ago, had a brief opportunity to drive Lucid's new Air Sapphire. So this is the tri-motor. I love this output figure because it's so easy to remember. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 1,234 horsepower version, top trim level of the Lucid Air. We made a video on it. You can read the review on Inside EVs. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. This car seems absolutely killer, and it made you make a weird noise, right, Brett?
Yeah, that's putting it well. Thank you. The first time we did a launch, I had a Lucid engineer sitting right next to me. We pulled up to a red light and just happened to be first in line. And he was like, "Hey, let's do a launch." And so he put it in the right modes for me, and you know, full brake, full throttle. And when the light turned green, like a little tiny ghost starting in my stomach just came out of my mouth, and I just it was like this guttural, like terrifying noise that I've never made before, and I hope to never make again, because this thing launches so hard. It's incredible. We get so jaded in the world of EVs by quick acceleration, you know, when everything like a Bolt or even like a Nissan Leaf has like a decent off the line shove. And it's kind of surprising the first time you feel it, but then you just get jaded because it happens over and over again in every single EV. This was insane. Back to that number figure, 1,234 horsepower makes it the most powerful production four-door sedan in history. And even in its smoothest, like least aggressive mode, it still makes more power than a Dodge Charger Hellcat, which is just truly insane to me that we're in a world now where even like the luxury spec of a car is more powerful than the formerly most powerful four-door sedan in history. So it's just an amazing machine. I had a whole lot of fun driving it.
Yeah, having done one launch control start in the Air Grand Touring Performance last year on that launch program, we shot video that I refused to let us publish because of the face that I made. I don't know what the sound was, but the face was absolutely god awful when that happened too. And I came away thinking like, I mean, listen, launch control is stupid. It's so much fun. It's really stupid, right? But does it maybe help somebody like convince themselves that they need to have a high performance electric vehicle? Absolutely. It also scares the crap out of me, just to be totally honest with you, because when I did it the first time in a, you know, like reasonably lower powered vehicle, I thought, I don't think regular drivers, you need to have a license to do this, or you need to be in like a safe area somewhere, right? I don't think you're allowed to, the public should just be allowed to do this on a city street whenever they want, to be blunt.
It was kind of amazing. And, you know, not to, you know, throw Lucid under the bus or anything like that. Most of the entire drive was done on city streets, and we were driving safely. We weren't like exceeding the speed limit excessively or anything like that. But the fact that, you know, I was just parked next to someone driving like a little Honda CRV from the 90s, and I was launching that hard, like it's ridiculous to me. The one like amazing thing about this car is, even when you are in full power mode, even when you've got launch control and like the drag strip mode turned on that gives you full draw on the battery, full power to the wheels, it's amazing how much control and grip you have in this car. Like, for it being as heavy as it is, for being as powerful as it is, it doesn't really set a foot wrong, which is kind of amazing for just a vehicle like this that isn't not a diehard like track rat. It's just a kind of a normal everyday luxury sedan, and it still just does amazing things.
So Lacey, do you have Sapphire yet on your schedule? Can we expect a review out of you in the near future too?
No, I don't think anytime soon. It'll be interesting to see how many people get access to this car, but I mean, look, I like Lucid, don't get me wrong, and it's cool that all these EVs are breaking records to become the fastest production cars, you know, that we've seen, and it's amazing. But like you said, how many times are you going to use it? Like, oh, let me show my friends a couple times here and there. I will say it's great that Lucid has also prioritized, you know, fast charging rates and a lot of range. But to me, like, I don't know, it just seems like to me they're still struggling a little bit because of the, if you're going to compete with like the, and I see obviously people are going to say, oh, Plaid, yeah, go against Plaid. Sure. We already have a product on the market that is debatably build quality is somewhat okay. And I'm not saying that the Lucid is bad, but if you are going to compete with like the Mercedes EQS and that type of luxury, a BMW, like i7, yes, it's great that it's faster than these products, but I think they need to like really up the luxury level for people to spend the money on that. That's just my opinion though. I don't know. I'd love to hear what you guys think, because it hurts my heart that they're having a hard time right now and ramping production and getting these out the door.
Yeah. Struggling to say the least. You know, we talked a little bit just now about Rivian turning the corner a bit in terms of profitability or lack of loss per vehicle. Lucid's numbers came out and are not great. They're losing a tremendous amount of money per vehicle, and nobody's entirely sure what that runway looks like. The thing that's always encouraged me about the company is, so because to answer your question, Lacey, I think I tend to agree. I think that, you know, we've seen reported issues of like thin paint quality and you know, some poor sort of rudimentary quality issues at Lucid, as we've seen with Tesla over the years as they're ramping up production and sort of figuring that out. Producing a vehicle the same way within, you know, spec at volume is an incredibly difficult thing to do, even when you are able to make some that are really impressive and have underlying technology that's really impressive. So fighting Mercedes is going to be tough on that quality front, and as they kind of, I think, get up to that standard.
I think that's a totally fair point. You know, I think that, like, especially at this price point, there are people who are just going to buy one as their, you know, third or fourth or fifth car, and they maybe already have an EQS in the driveway for luxury reasons. But, you know, the broader Air lineup, just it can't quite compete yet at that S-Class EQS level of quality and luxury, which is unfortunate, because I really love Lucid as a brand. I really love kind of like the idea that it's like, they're trying to like build a complete, fully baked car from day one, which I really appreciate. But, you know, there's still kinks to work out.
I mean, powertrain is exceptional. Like, there's no doubt about that. Like, it's amazing what they've achieved in miniaturizing those motors and just the power output and all this stuff. It's just like incredible. But that's just my like.
Well, and I wonder little two if, cents. I wonder if it's going to get better now that they've got some big, you know, bigger OEM partners or some higher profile OEM partners. I wonder if some money's going to come in that they're going to be able to refine both the incredible powertrain technology and also be able to invest some of their development costs into refining it a little bit and giving it some more luxury options and features that people expect at this price.
But has money ever really been like Lucid's big problem compared to actually delivering stuff? Because like,
not yet.
I remember speaking to Lucid.
They're also Saudi backed.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to say they have so much petrochemical money behind them. And like when I spoke to Lucid in 2021, actually, I think me and Seth were working together at the time. And like I did an hour and a half long interview with their design team, and I came out of it and I was like, I don't think there's anything to publish here. I don't think they're ever going to make a car. So like the fact that they actually have made some cars that are being delivered and stuff, I thought they were the next an ultra luxe Middle Eastern backed Faraday future, basically.
Sure.
Maybe without quite so much fraud because they had the money, but like I think Lucid are a really odd proposition to me. Like they want to be this disruptor, but they also want to get to a very old market of like people who buy incredibly expensive collection cars, basically.
Yeah, totally agree. I would only say, and as producer Kyle is spurring us along, that I have always been impressed after my first meeting with Lucid and hearing Rawlinson speak about a little bit the sort of fundamentals of the way that they're, first of all, like retaining a lot of control over how they're building and designing things in-house. I think that they're building in efficiencies. We're talking a lot about efficiency of a vehicle, but I think that they're also building in efficiencies, cost efficiencies in their production strategies too, that to me have always given them potential that some of their contemporaries don't have to go down market a lot and build things. We had a comment just a few minutes ago from Stu asking about, you know, is it more important basically to build impressive things or build and service things at a reasonable price, right? I do think that from the top down, that the you know, people running the company at Lucid believe that they need to sell something with great service at a reasonable price. But the strategy, the sort of top-down strategy, is one that is, you know, it's been around forever. Tesla used it to great success, obviously, and we're seeing it happen kind of across the board with only a few exceptions as this next generation of EVs comes out. So really interesting. All right, speaking of Tesla, we've got to talk about some Tesla news. We've got an aggregation of Tesla news today. I love the Tesla news block. We might have to work on, we've got some writers in this organization. We can figure out something there. All right. So out of Tesla, like really we've been following a group of stories. This week we've had a number of headlines around Cybertruck, right? Cybertruck is now in production. We are getting closer, we think, to trucks that are actually going to be delivered to customers. Hazel and I were laughing in the meeting before the show that a lot of this is predicated on there being like a singular Cybertruck seemingly covered, that the theory was it was production spec in the parking lot, right? So we do think that there's a line of sight. And listen, this has been 4 years or so now, right? Since we first heard about it, many, many well-documented issues with this stuff that we've been talking about all day, you know, sort of production constraints. And now, you know, we're talking about the tires that it will be running, right? And again, seeing them in real life. Who here, show of hands, feels bullish that we are really there, that these are going to start hitting customers' driveways in the next, I don't know, certainly before the end of the year. How about in the next 2 months? Anyone feel good about that?
I would be surprised if it's by the end of the year, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just salty because Elon always says, oh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming, and it just never hits. But I don't know. I think maybe at the beginning of next year. I would love to be proved wrong, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that we all are dying at this point, like good, bad, or otherwise. Obviously, a very polarizing vehicle. I've always thought like it looks amazing. It seems to look a little less cool every time I see a production version of one, just because it's not complete. It's a little screwed up. I'm looking now at, again, we had a story from earlier in the week about the, you know, again, spy shots about the frunk not being as big as it could be, right? But some weird angles on the thing. But I want to drive one. I want to see other people drive one and read the reviews and see the coverage of it. And I want to see what real people have to say about it when it starts hitting the streets. So this just feels like the longest tease in the history of automotive that I can remember in my 20 years of covering it, right? Like maybe I'm missing one.
Maybe Roadster people might be fighting you on that. Because they want their free ones.
Tesla obviously doesn't face the exact same hurdles that we've been talking about as they've been at this and at it at scale for a long time. But is Cybertruck just snake bit? What's the deal here? Is it too different from everything they've been doing in the past?
I mean, I think there's some stories that like people are interested in because they're excited to see if they will happen. And like, there's been a couple recently and like, a couple of weeks ago, there was the story about the room temperature superconductors, which was really, really exciting, really optimistic, especially in terms of efficiency of not necessarily for vehicles, but for power delivery and stuff. And it turned out to be a bust, but people got excited about it just because the possibility of it happening was so world changing. And I feel like the Cybertruck, a lot of not that Tesla has a marketing department, but if it did, they would like the idea of the Cybertruck to be being delivered to be in that same world changing area. I mean, maybe if I had put an order in for one, which I never would, then because I don't know where I'd park that in London, to be blunt.
Just wait for your cat to start meowing, then we'll find out if you really need one.
She might want one. She quite likes running into things. I feel like it's just something where people are kind of bored of it not happening now. It's sort of turned into entertainment about how delayed the Cybertruck is, how different the Cybertruck is. I personally don't think there's going to be a version that looks an awful lot like the renders or particularly behaves anything like it's been promised. We already know it's significantly altered from what was originally pitched, even when they opened orders. And this is going to be a really compromised vehicle by the time it gets to the road. I feel really honestly pretty bad for everyone who's ordered one and put deposits down on one, because I personally do not see a light at the end of the delivery tunnel for the Cybertruck as things stand.
Yeah, I mean, talking about, still waiting on Rivians and waiting on vehicles that maybe you were able to put an order in on in the last year and a half or something like that. Some of these folks have been waiting quite a long time. Listen, I'm still, maybe I'm the crazy optimist here, and I'm certainly no huge supporter of Tesla, but I can say that their product has been surprisingly well received, sold very well, and ultimately pretty well realized, better and better year in and year out too. So they've made a significant amount of progress. I guess my point of view is it's taking forever. I agree, Hazel, that especially in the first run, you're probably going to find a lot of just crazy weird things going wrong with this vehicle, defects and stuff like that. I also have some faith that Tesla will figure it out if it's proves to be a viable sort of commercial enterprise. You know, in other words, people still want to buy them after they hit the road going forward. I think the track record is absolutely there for them to be able to build on the initial quality and raise it pretty quickly as they enter production with this. Am I being starry-eyed there, or?
I think you've nailed it on the head, in my opinion. I mean, what have they got, like 2 million reservations or something like that? Like, outrageous. Easy. Like, I mean, ultimately, I think there are a ton of people that already own Teslas that are planning on getting one. And I know someone that is also getting one. Tim is getting one, and he's actually got an order for multiple. And my buddy Ryan, the Kilowatts, he's got like 50 of them on order. So it's like, I think that I think they're going to be like, maybe they won't live up to what they were initially expecting them to be. But I think that most people that are going to buy them are just going to be like happy as clams no matter what and not complain too much. You'll get some complainers, but like, what Tim has an order in on one that's the 500 mile range one is what he wanted with the tri-motor, but are they even going to come out with that one? Like, when? Like, probably not, but he's got like one of the first 1,000 or some crazy early number.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see when they do come out, what is really going to make it to the car? What is it like? And it does look a little, I don't know, different than what the renders show, for sure. But it still looks weird enough that I think people are just going to embrace it regardless.
that was going to be my question is like, when you look at the compromises that it goes from, you know, the initial promises and the initial renderings to the final product, if you can take the earlier promises, the earlier renderings out of the picture, is it still going to be a weird, attention grabbing, like exciting vehicle? And I think it still is. I think it's still going to be pretty cool, even if it doesn't quite live up to, you know, what was promised back in 2019 or whatever. I think it's still going to be, people are going to be pretty excited to see one on the road. It's still going to grab some attention. And that's, I'm saying that as, you know, very much not a Tesla person. So I still think it's going to work pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the floor is pretty low for the possible outcomes of Cybertruck, but the ceiling is still very high, right? The floor is that it's a vehicle that everybody remembers as a famous flop, right? Maybe DeLorean-esque. I think I know that's a popular comparison because of the way that it looks and the stainless steel and all that stuff. But like, I think from a business case standpoint, you can see it going that way too. And the ceiling is, I don't know what car comp is there that's appropriate, because it's certainly not like Model T, but definitely has the ability to do a whole new thing for automotive design in addition to vehicle sort of functionality too. In a little bit of a strange way. So the ceiling, I think, on it is pretty high as well. It all just comes down to execution at this point. And maybe a little bit of the changing sentiment overall towards Tesla vis-a-vis Elon Musk, right? And sort of his waxing and waning popularity. Cool. All right. Well, listen, lots more on Cybertruck to come. You guys like know where to find it. On Inside EVs, we have Cybertruck stories just about every day, I would say, and certainly plenty of Tesla news too. So we will continue to try and reflect that here. One other thing that we want to do, just to break things up a little bit, we've been talking a lot about the news, is just screw around a little bit and have sort of a fun gamey segment at the end of each one of these podcasts. So this week, I was reading a lot about the vehicle that I don't have in front of me anymore. It's Sinister. I keep wanting to say Sinister. That's not right. Where are my show notes?
Sacrilege.
Sacrilege. Thank you, Hazel. Right. The Sacrilege Motors has built a pretty impressive looking 1992 Porsche 911 Cabriolet with a Model 3 drivetrain in it. And it's another car that's going to come to Pebble or something like that for, you know, to impress a bunch of rich people. I'm sure it's very well done and it's very cool. But to me, it immediately opens up the question, which is not a new one, but interesting, which is, if you were going to do an EV conversion of any classic vehicle or vehicle that you've really loved over the years, what would you do, right? So what's the dream car, maybe because of form or personal history or something like that, that you think would make an amazing car as an electric vehicle? And I'll open this up to you guys. We're not going to be able to read all of the answers here, but as if you have an answer to this too, like what's the classic car that you would like to remake as an EV? By all means, let us know. And we'll have a chance to call it out later. But Brett, I'll start with you. Your dream EV conversion of a classic vehicle is?
Simply because it follows the American ethos of gigantic is better. I think I would do a 1961 or 1962 Lincoln Continental. The really slick, there it is right there. That's the four-door hardtop with the suicide doors. You also got a four-door Cabrio, a four-door convertible as well. You know, my thinking is kind of along the lines of like F-150 Lightning. You've got a big body on frame vehicle. It's got tons of space for batteries between those frame rails. You can pack the, you know, pack the front of the car with some, you know, some batteries as well. And I think you could get a pretty impressive, very smooth riding, very, very powerful luxury convertible out of this car. And it just has style for days. And this is a car where I don't think the engine, as much as the 911 for sure, I don't think the engine adds to the character very much. I think it's kind of just there to get the thing down the road. So I think this is a perfect example for a torquey, smooth EV conversion.
It'd be so cool.
You could have such a huge frunk as well.
Oh my God.
I like how it says smart new size on that advertisement.
That's great. Because it was downsized. I don't know how they downsized from anything to this, but that's what they did.
Yeah, no, I think this is, first of all, this is an inspiring choice, beautiful vehicle, plenty of room to do whatever you want with it, make the frunk as big as you want. I need to call out really quickly Nikki94 for saying the classic Fiat Panda 4x4. I think they're saying specifically from the 90s. That's an amazing choice. I'm actually a little bit jealous that I didn't pick that, because I am a tremendous Fiat 4x4 stan. And probably next time I go to Italy, this is a total digression. There is a museum I just found out about that's dedicated only to the first generation Fiat Panda 4x4s in Italy. Now that I know that it exists, I have to go. I'm going to suggest, if they haven't already, they do an EV conversion, and we'll make a bunch of stories about it. It'd be amazing.
That's a funny Stan Hoodism, I guess.
Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense at all. But I've had many conversations with people in Europe about what it would cost to buy one and ship them over. And it turns out, like everything else, I missed the boat. I should have done it like 3 years ago, and now it's going to be triple the price. So, Well, listen, I'll go next quickly because Brett, because I think that we've got some synergy here in the 60s sort of muscly car thing. A car that I always wanted to own. My first dream car was a 1966 Pontiac GTO. That's the one with the stacked headlights. They only made this for 2 years, I believe, this body style. I really like the coupe. This is, I shared this exact listing with Kyle because it's my dream spec. Black coupe. Obviously 66, it's even got the correct wheels on it. Brian Jackson said, Seth, you've got to channel your inner Kyle. Aren't you the guy who wants to drive all these EVs sideways? And the answer is yes, this is it right there. So this is not an all-wheel drive vehicle. This is a rear-wheel drive vehicle with electric power, probably tripling what it put out when it was new. I think it would be a donut machine, a burnout machine. And because it was never particularly great handling, it's just fast in a straight line. It'll be easy to get sideways, and with all that torque, it'll be better than ever. Basically, if they had the technology in 1966, I'm sure this would have been a high-powered EV to begin with. So, all right, Hazel, what do you got?
I sent through a really specific car for this because I am working. Well, working. Like a lot of car journalists, I have a project, or particularly after a certain age, it's like at some point we start acquiring project cars and like going steadily wrong. It's like your knees get worse, you get more project cars. mine is a 1993 Renault Twingo, so the original actual Renault Twingo. So for all of the Americans, yes, this is my car. Yes, it does have a towing capacity. And all
live
of,
in that field.
It's a project car.
Sadly, it lives on the road behind my flat, where it unfortunately takes quite a lot of knocks. But to be fair, she had taken quite a few knocks in her life after spending 16 years fighting Fiat Pandas in Madrid. But she clearly won all the fights she had. So
yeah,
clearly.
This is the happiest car in the world. They're so cute. They are so.
I love her. They're so fun to drive as well, because like it's got no horsepower, so like you can just drive it flat all the time. There's a lot of stuff that I'm
adorable little Hello Kitty smile. I love it so much.
But yeah, she needs a lot of work. I'm going to have to replace a lot of her frame with a much stronger frame, because obviously she's not used to any horsepower really at all, let alone kind of like an EV launch. Original plan was to fit her with some race car parts, but I think I'm going to have to sort of remodify my ambitions there, especially if I'm ever actually going to do it at all, which it's now 2.5 years and counting. So in the classic project car space. But yes, this is the car I will convert.
Does it ever end? Hazel, you'll just get another one.
You've got more of a motivation now, because we're gonna create an audience hungry for Twingo conversion content going forward. So we'll have to talk about that offline for sure. But I think we should make it happen.
I'm gonna be feeling starry eyed all day with your pick. Oh, it's so great. Very
cute. That's one I'll be happy to have burned in my brain.
Yeah,
it's so cute.
All right, Lacey, take us home. What's your classic EV?
Okay, so this is really hard to choose, because obviously there's so many good ones, but ultimately my number one is a 1948 Ford F1, which is a pickup truck, and they made it for a couple of years in this body style. This is one that I saw. I was doing a launch program for the Nissan Ariya this year, and I was going into the mall, and I was walking around, and I was like, I almost passed away. I was like, oh my God, it's the truck. I will love this truck. This is my truck. Unfortunately, you can see it's a display piece, but this is the truck I would love to have converted into an EV. I'm a truck girl. I like to have a little bit higher seating position because I'm a 5'11". I don't know why. Just being tall, I like to be sitting up a little bit higher. And I just have always loved this truck. Like, I don't even know for how long. I've been obsessed with it, and I've wanted one for a very long time. And I've even like went to go put bids on them and like many years ago, but I never seemed to pull the trigger on it. But one day I would love to
They're amazing. Yes. Well, the good news is, the bad news is that they're really expensive. The good news is that as the boomers start to die off, I think they'll get cheaper. So if you can just hang on.
Just wait for death and eventually, no. I have seen them when they're fully restored, they're expensive. But the ones that I've seen that are kind of like fair condition, like, yes, of course, you would need to put some work into them. You can see like maybe like the teens to 20s and stuff. And I think that's okay enough to invest. Now, my second car that I was having a hard time picking was the Jaguar E-Type because it's just, I think, one of the most beautiful cars on the planet ever. And this is the one I actually took these pictures at the Quail in 2018 when I saw it. They this is the second iteration because they did the first concept version, the Concept Zero, and then they had the Series 1 or whatever it was. But this was the second iteration that they showed off at the Quail back in 2018 when I was working there. And absolutely stunning vehicle. It's hard to pick, but I've been saying for years, like an MG MGA is what I would want to have because it's like the cheap, I guess, version that's like more affordable, doable version of this. But ultimately, if I had the cash, then this would be the one. I was going to go for that body style, but
it's so good. And there are a couple of companies. We have a story. So editor Jeff Perez at Motor One did a drive with a company called ECD. I think it used to be East Coast Defenders that are doing, they're doing resto mods that are really high level, but they're also doing an EV conversion of Jaguar E-Types, which are beautiful and apparently really amazing to drive. So it makes sense. I mean, this is a shape that we all want to live forever. And so we need to future-proof it to a certain extent, right? Awesome. Guys, this has been really amazing. I don't know if we have it queued up or not, but I want to at least put the ask out there in the, as you guys are continuing to listen, as again, we're sort of like revamping the podcast. I want everybody to, you know, load us up with questions. We'd love to have a end the show on a question or comment of the week. There are a ton of good ones from the Escalade debut post that we have on InsideEVs.com that we probably won't have a chance to get to right now. But I want to put it out there. You guys can email us at contact@InsideEVs.com with any questions, suggestions for segments that you would like to hear or comments that you'd like for us to read and sort of talk about at the end of the show. I think that would be fantastic. You can also always go to Inside EVs to explore the wild and very robust world of comments there on all of the stories that we post. But mostly, I want to thank you a ton for hanging with us today, for coming back. We are going to be here every Friday at 9:30 a.m. Eastern time again, bringing you all of that hot EV content with a selection of this group of hosts, plus new hosts to come. And some friends and guests filtering through on a regular basis. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel. You guys might be seeing this on Twitter. You might be watching it live on the site too. Wherever you are, if you're seeing this on social media, please follow us, like us, subscribe. We need all the help that we can get, and we'd love to continue to grow this audience. So appreciate everybody. Thanks you guys for joining us. This has been a ton of fun, and I'll see you all next week.
See you guys. Thanks for watching.
Bye.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch, Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.